You're listening to audio from Flyway, Journal of Writing and Environment. For more audio, and to read poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and flight patterns, the Flyway blog, visit flyway.org.
Hello, my name is Lindsay Tighe. I am the former nonfiction editor of Flyway and a second-year candidate in the MFA program of Creative Writing and Environment at Iowa State. I got the chance to sit down and speak with poet and naturalist Elizabeth Bradfield while she was here for the 9th Annual Symposium for Wildness, Wilderness, and the Creative Imagination. So for my first question, I was interested in the way that you describe yourself as a poet and a naturalist. And as a naturalist participating in marine field research and, you said, in-field presentations, you also describe yourself as an aspiring generalist. And I thought that was really interesting. And I was just wondering if you could explain a little bit more how you see those terms working. And also, this is kind of a separate second question, but how you balance between the poet part of that and your naturalist generalist part of your job description.
Mm-hmm. Where to start? I think the aspiring generalist thing I'll begin with, because when I'm working as a naturalist, mostly what I'm doing is working on, well, I work locally on Cape Cod on short 3-hour whale watches, and that's very clear cut. But the other naturalist work I do is on expedition ships, ecotourism. So I'm with a team of other naturalists, and we travel with people for a week, up to 3 weeks, wherever. Mm-hmm. Alaska, the Amazon, Antarctica, the Arctic. And everyone, all the naturalists kind of have their expertise, you know? And my training is not in science. And I kind of came into this work as a naturalist through the back door. It was always my interest.
Mm-hmm.
And in college, I studied marine biology, but didn't end up with the paper to prove it. So in the field, before working as a naturalist, I helped out with various projects, spent a lot of time in the marine environment, in particular with marine mammals. And so now, the more I think about it, the less interested I am in claiming an expertise, because I feel like the more I look, mm-hmm. the more mystified I am. And studying whales got me really interested in pelagic birds.
Mm, gives you a wider scope.
Yeah. And so what I'm interested in is everything. You know, yeah. It is. It's the culture, it's the nature, it's the birds, it's the whales, it's the lichen, it's the tundra ecosystem, it's the barnacles, it's the nudibranchs. And this, I think, is why I'm interested in both poetry and natural history, is I don't want to weight those differently.
Mm-hmm.
They're all interesting to me. They're all important. And if I throw them into the big jumble and allow them to tumble around in there, then it gets interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
If I try and limit myself too much and say, you know, I am looking at entanglement rates of gray seals on haulouts of Cape Cod. Yeah, I'm interested in that, but that's not, I'm not a narrow focus kind of gal.
Satisfy your curiosity for everything else.
I'm always like the dog and up in the air looking at the squirrel. You know, there's a squirrel.
Right.
My attention is distracted by something else. And I want to honor that distraction and that kind of desire to be a more traditional naturalist and person in the world, a generalist.
Mm-hmm.
I think being a generalist is a wonderful thing, and I think in our society we are moving toward specialization. In the medical field, you see it. You also see it in other fields as well, certification programs for this, that, and the other thing. And I'm much more interested in not being certified and kind of doing things that I'm interested in. I mean, it's a very selfish desire in doing what I want to do.
Yeah.
So being a generalist.
Okay. Great. So then,
I think I lost some of your question there, so I have to repeat.
That's okay. So then my next question was, how do you balance or pinball between being a poet and a naturalist?
Awkwardly. Awkwardly. I think I was saying, maybe I was saying at lunch today that I like being a spy,
mm-hmm.
you know, having a secret life. So here I am sitting with you and talking about poetry. And, you know, in my secret life, I'm thinking about gray seals, uh-huh. you know? And when I'm in the field as a naturalist talking about gray seals or whales or birds or whatever, then my secret life is being a poet, you know, observing this through a poet's eye, observing that through a biologist's eye. And for me, my time, I don't do both at once very well. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to integrate them. And recently I've been able to give a couple of talks that address that kind of jumble, talking about in particular Arctic science and the poems that have come from that investigation. Mm-hmm. And I think I've been able to talk about that because I've come into both as an experienced naturalist and experienced poet. Immersing myself in the Arctic has been a place where I've been able to combine the two a lot more successfully. But when I'm working as a naturalist, I'm not writing poems. Mm-hmm. And when I'm working on poems, I don't want to think like a naturalist per se. I want to think a lot more mm-hmm. loosely and have language rather than consequence mm-hmm. be at the forefront. So I seesaw.
Well, it seems like for a lot of writers, kind of having that outsider perspective is where some of the most interesting ideas come in. So that makes a lot of sense to me. My next question kind of talked about this a little bit earlier, but I was wondering what role research plays in your work, if most of it is kind of that hands-on, you know, naturalist field research, or if you do a lot of book research as well, and if that process was different between your two books, Interpretive Work and Approaching Ice, how did that change?
Honestly, the poems, in a weird way, I see those two first books as my one first book, mm-hmm. Because a lot of the poems were written concurrently.
Okay.
I was working on the poems of both books at the same time. Mm-hmm. Interpretive Work was finished first and accepted first, and the poems of Approaching Ice, there were a few things I needed to finish up before that became a complete manuscript, but really there were many years where those poems were both kind of moving forward and accumulating and rumbling around. So there are two really different modes, I think. And I find myself now in a similar position. I have two manuscripts that I'm working on. One is closer to completion and the other is a little bit further away. One is more from daily life and personal experience, which is true of interpretive work. And the other is more driven by a concept, a research project, some of the research being book research, some of the research in this case, unlike Approaching Ice, being more like investigative journalism, going to places and experiencing things. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important for me to, I don't want all of those things in the same book, but I like having a project that I can move forward with however long it takes me, mm-hmm. you know, 5 years, 10 years. I am working on poems about polar exploration. And then these other things kind of come in, mm-hmm. and suddenly you realize, oh, wow, I have a lot of these. Maybe they're a book. What are they saying? What's going on with those?
You kind of have two different types of book projects going at any one time.
Yeah.
It makes sense. When you're beginning a new poem, I was wondering where your ideas come from, and if kind of how that plays into your writing process, if it changes while you're working on that poem over time.
Yeah, you know, I used to say, and it used to be true, that it was sound. Mm-hmm. A first line of a poem would come to me and it would be kind of incantatory and it would stick around in my head and I had to follow it. And that still happens to me sometimes. But increasingly, what I'm trying to, I feel like as poets, it's our job to be tuning forks, mm-hmm. right? To be ready to resonate in one way, shape, or form or another. And what I am interested in are the moments of resonance that are deeply strange. Like I overhear something or see something or read something and I think, wow, that is really weird and a little bit messed up. Mm-hmm. That to me is an exciting moment for a poem. Something I can't wait to come home and tell my partner about. Can you believe mm-hmm. whatever it is? That to me is an interesting moment for a poem because there's shock and uncertainty and curiosity and all of those things in a confusing emotional jumble, for me are the exciting materials to work with.
Does it ever happen for you that what starts the poem ends up getting cut from the poem in the end?
Yeah.
Or?
Oh, yeah, definitely. definitely. And some poems, a lot of poems for me, take a very long time to write. And that doesn't mean I sit down every day and work on them. But the time for me that I put a poem in a drawer and leave it for a month or a year or whatever, that's important too. That kind of sitting there and being there and letting other things happen in my life and then pulling that poem out of the metaphoric drawer because they're on the computer, not the drawer, and looking at it again and seeing if it still feels fresh and it still has the surprise and the weight that it felt like it did when I first wrote it. So that kind of time away is really critical for me in my writing process. Very few poems fall onto the page, although some do.
So it can vary, but for the most part you have to give it a little space and come back to it.
Space and time. I'm slow.
Yeah.
I'm slow.
I understand that.
Yeah.
So I was, when re-examining your poems throughout the process of writing your two books and your works in progress, I was wondering how, if you feel you've changed or evolved as a poet over time, when you go back and you read your earlier work, has anything changed for the way you approach individual poems or large scale projects?
That's a really good question. I think it's easier to draw, it's easy to draw parallels between book A and book B and book 1 and book 2. So if book A is interpretive work, the collection that I'm finishing now that I think is going to be titled Once Removed, those feel in conversation to me. And what's changed from interpretive work to Once Removed is an interest in coldness. Not as in a temperature the body feels, but in terms of tone. And in not allowing my vulnerable and romantic self to be the main speaker, but my more cynical self.
Okay.
Still looking at engagements of the human and the natural world, the social self, and the biological self, and how that's all muddy and messed up. Still looking at family and place in the world, but with a colder eye. The poems of Approaching Ice were very armchair traveler poems. So between Approaching Ice and this new Macmillan book, I want to have a lot more at stake personally. It was. The poems of Approaching Ice were the poems of an obsession, right? I was obsessed with this polar travel and why they did it. And I didn't have any skin in the game.
Okay.
You know, I hadn't really traveled very much to either pole. Hadn't traveled to Antarctica at all. It's been a little bit of time in the North. And now I've spent more time in the North, and I want to write about my own experiences there more directly set against the explorers and not just judge them and imagine them,
right?
But try and have a real and felt contrast between the two.
Okay, that's interesting. You kind of asked me this earlier, but I was wondering what poets have influenced you, and then a second question would be, what contemporary poets are you currently excited about? Kind of answer them together if that works.
Yeah. I think I was very lucky as an undergraduate to study with Linda Beards, and you never know, you know, when things are going to converge. But she, for me, is an amazing role model and poet, and was someone who I had a natural resonance with, the way that she worked and the way that she approached poems. I admire her so tremendously. So she's a touchstone for me. I have huge admiration for Evan Boland, for her intellectual clarity and the grace of her lyric. Recently, I've been reading Stephen Dunn quite a bit, and I love his kind of hard-boiled vulnerability, the blend of cranky and romantic that he finds in his work. Anyone who can write a villanelle about Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan wins in my book. You know, I think that's
success.
Fantastic. Yes. So those are poets that are important to me. And there are so many others. There are so many.
Right.
You know, Philip Larkin, I think, not all of his work, but some of it I find really stunning. Coleridge was really important to me as a younger writer, T.S. Eliot. And now, recently, I think, like, what do you call recent?
Still alive.
Yeah. Books that have just knocked my socks off have been Morris Manning's Bucolics. I think that's a stunning book. Also, Cecily Parks's book, Field, Folly, Snow. Amazing, amazing book. I'll read anything that Carl Phillips writes. I'll buy all of his books. I always want to know what he's up to.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been loving, I don't know that they're in a collection or not yet, but I've been really blown away by the recent work I've been seeing by Ellen Bryant Voigt in The New Yorker. I don't often respond to poems in The New Yorker, but she's been doing these amazing, dense, winding, syntactical poems that okay. I love. I love, love, love.
Great. So in an interview that you did with Connotation Press, you said that living in Alaska made you realize how important, quote, the edge of roadlessness is to you, how wonderful it is to walk in places where wild animals like bears and moose are present and demand your attentive respect. I thought since you're visiting for the Wildness Symposium, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your relationship to wildness and how it informs your work.
Mm-hmm. I think that idea of the world demanding attention is really important. I think this is why I enjoy spending time on boats. If you mm-hmm. don't pay attention to the weather, you're an idiot. You really need to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you can get into deep trouble. And that sense that you can't enter the interior fully if you're not attentive, you will become mm-hmm. physically endangered.
Well, what I notice about being on a boat too is just how much more you focus in on different things. Like mm-hmm. your ability to pay attention changes mm-hmm. in different wild places.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that. I just really liked that idea of they demand your attentive respect.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that we think about a lot here in
yeah.
terms of like what is wilderness and you know how do you know when you're in it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's a thing that I. You know, living now on Cape Cod and away from Alaska, it's all about the water.
Okay.
You know, the woods, the predators are different. The predators are ticks and Lyme disease.
Right.
You know, they're not bear and moose. And that's a different kind of attentiveness. But because that spit of land is so vulnerable, because it's all sand, because it sticks out there into the Atlantic like a sore thumb, because
mm-hmm.
it's dangerously low in terms of sea level, weather and climate are something that are their own wildness there because they demand that attention. So I guess I would say that anything in which your attention is yanked back to the physical present is wildness, whether that's urban
okay.
or rural or untrammeled.
Yeah, that's
as
a really interesting idea.
Says.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about your editorial venture, Broadsided Press. In an earlier interview, you described it as a, quote, literary/visual collaborative grassroots/virtual press. And I was wondering if you could explain that a little bit and then kind of just a little bit about what role you envision the combination of visual art and poetry serving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a long slash definition, right? I started the press... In a large part, out of envy, envy for the tools and the play and the visuals of visual arts.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like entering an artist's studio and then all those little, you know,
so tactile
things of paint, little boxes of things, and you never know how it's going to be used. But there's this visual richness of things that you can play with. And if you enter a writer's room, sure, you'll have some like pictures and maybe some notebooks, but it's boring.
Sheafs of paper.
Yeah, it's not visible.
Right.
It's not visible. And it's so fun to enter that visual landscape. And I also think, I think poetry for me is so important as a way of understanding the world, as a way of making sense of emotion and politics and strange moments in mm-hmm. our lives, and yet, and I think this is actually becoming less so, and yet it's so shut off into a cordon of highfalutinness.
Mm-hmm.
And that breaks my heart, and I don't think it should be that way. And so I wanted to think about a way to... People are not afraid of art like they are afraid of poetry. So how can art help poetry be heard? And how can poetry inspire artists?
It's like a spoonful of sugar.
A little bit, but that devalues...
Yeah.
I don't want it to... You know, it's
just in their eyes.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's complicated.
Yeah.
But what I wanted was to show how those things can reverberate against each other. So the press really started because I wanted to see what visual artists would do. I mean, God, what would someone do with my poem? What would they see?
Right.
When they see a poem? What might happen? And how can I get poetry into our visual culture in a way that'll make someone stop? Mm-hmm. Like an ad, like a poster for a band might, or an ad for whatever.
Right.
You know? So it kind of came from that. And then also, increasingly, we started, maybe a year or two in, we started this feature called Collaborators Q&A, in which we ask the artist and the writer, who have no input once they send their stuff in to me,
mm-hmm.
Over the final product. They're both kind of presented with the final product. I wanted to know how it felt to respond, to be responded to. What happens when the two come together? Do they change? Is there some kind of shift that happens when the two are resting together visually on the page?
I imagine. So we're talking a little bit about the MFA program here. We were talking about how it's kind of unique in the fact that we have a focus on the environment, which allows us students to explore interdisciplinary subjects relating to the environment in various ways, whether science, art, architecture, history. And I was wondering if you, what are some of your favorite environmental writers, whether they're mm-hmm. poets or not, and how or if you define environmental writers?
Mm-hmm. That's a big question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, where to begin? There are so many that I feel so indebted to. I mean, it's interesting. I was talking about Scammons with one of the other students here. He's an environmental writer I'm super interested in, Joel
uh-huh.
Scammons. There's this new book out by Eva Salitis that I'm reading that I think is wonderful about killer whales in Alaska. I think Carl Safina does amazing books. I think that book, Scott Wiedenthal's Living on the Wind, is an amazing history of bird migration. I'm kind of all over the map. I'm more subject-driven when it comes to environmental reading.
Okay.
Than author-driven. I do think, when I think about writers who I really admire in terms of how they formulate a question, Richard Nelson, who wrote The Island Within, and then also Heart and Blood, about the lives of white-tailed deer in North America, I think he's a really interesting writer because he allows the complexity to be there. And he also, I think sometimes with nonfiction and environmental writing, there becomes this valorization of the self as character moving through understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very suspicious of that. And I'm interested in the writers who sidestep that
okay.
one way or another.
Yeah, that makes sense. In our environmental literature class last year, we read a lot of the man goes out in nature model.
Yeah.
Like the Henry Beston and all of these other examples. And when we finally saw something that broke that mold, it was very refreshing. So I can understand that.
Yeah.
But, So one of my last question, I guess, is that recently I was at the AWP conference, and it seemed like this theme came up again and again about the importance of community in poetry and how crucial it is for fellow poets to share poems and kind of just a love of poetry, just because of the fact that the work of a poet can at times feel isolating. So I was wondering, this is something I've been thinking about, how I will attain a poetry community after the shelter of an MFA program. And I was wondering what role the larger poetic community plays in your work and your life as a poet.
You know, it's interesting. I think that idea of the journey of retreat and return
mm-hmm.
in wilderness writing, you know, Rorda talks about that, is also true for me in poetry. It's when I rarely share work in progress. I have a lot of friends who are writers, and talking with them generally about what we're working on, what we're struggling with, what we're going to do is really important, to feel like I have peers engaged in the work.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't often look for feedback until pretty far along in the process, because I think that solitude of being with the work and not having an outside influence too soon is really important to me,
mm-hmm.
to be able to tumble it around and kick it and pull it apart and put it back together.
On your own.
On my own is important
mm-hmm.
to me. I enjoy that process.
Yeah.
I don't want that taken away from me.
Right.
You know, and I don't want someone else's imprint on it too soon.
Right.
I need the shape to be a little bit more firm. So a writing community is really important to me, but not poem by poem,
okay.
if that makes sense.
More in, like, sharing poets that you enjoy and
yeah.
kind of inspiration.
Yeah,
like that.
I'm reading
encouragement.
This. I'm working on this essay. It's driving me crazy. I'm sorry. I'm working on this thing. It's driving me crazy. Just the sense that there's other people out there who are engaged in the work is almost one of the most important things. But then there's this other excitement that happens, like when you're at a conference like AWP or the ASLE conference or whatever, Gathering of Writers, Bread Loaf or Swanee or whatever. When those people come together and there's that energy of all those people bringing forward the concerns and starting to see trends in the conversation, whether it's aesthetic trends or subject trends or whatever, that's really fascinating too.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to immerse in that and then run away.
Then run away.
Yeah,
that makes
the
a lot of sense.
Running away is important.
Yes, I definitely felt that this year after AWP.
Oh, that's overwhelming, right?
It definitely is.
You've been listening to audio from Flyway, Journal of Writing and Environment. For more information, visit flyway.org. Music provided by Jaber Crowe.